You make a deal with Netflix and you don't have money that comes into you forever. You get paid and then money 20% more or 30% more, but that's it.
It didn't come natural to me. There's so many things that I think about now I wish I had known when I was younger.
What I believe resonates with people who are particularly now is content that has some sort of meaning to it. It's more than just pure entertainment.
And so suddenly MTV was the only thing, it seemed, in the whole world, and all of Hollywood and everybody else was taking their cues from this startup.
I did not know a single writer when I became a writer. I think if you're trying to become a writer from someplace other than Los Angeles and New York, I still think that's really difficult.
Welcome to Hollywood Wolfpack with Kaya Alexander, featuring in-depth interviews and insights with professionals in the entertainment business. Get everything you need to navigate your above-the-line career right here. This podcast is often recorded live in front of Kaya students in the Entertainment Business School. You can find out more at entertainmentbusinessschool.com. Hollywood Wolfpack is the new face of entertainment business wisdom. Enjoy the show.
All right. Hi, and welcome. I'm Kaya Alexander, the host of Hollywood Wolfpack, and you're here today with my very special guest, my attorney, Philip Rosen. Philip Rosen in the house of Rosen Law Group. Welcome, Philip.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So happy that you're here. I love having you on as a special guest. You're so full of knowledge, and you've been so generous with the students. We're recording live in front of the class of the Entertainment Business School today. And I would love for you to introduce yourself to the students. This class hasn't met you before. Some of our listeners might not have heard you on the show before. So if you could tell us a little bit of your background, that would be fantastic.
Of course. So I studied law at Stanford, and after graduating, I went to work in New York for the music business for RCA and PolyGram. And then I moved to Los Angeles. I was joined New Line Cinema. I was their senior vice president of business and legal affairs for 7 years, and worked on movies like The Mask, Seven, Nightmare on Elm Street movies, House Party movies. And then from there, went to a large law firm called Baker Hostetler. I was their partner in charge of movies and TV. And then after that, opened up my own practice. And we're a boutique entertainment law firm representing writers, producers, directors, actors, production companies, distributors, financiers. We do everything in film and television, and even some music as well.
Did your business affairs experience give you an insight, an insider scoop on how to approach everybody as you started your own law firm?
Yeah, it gave me a perspective that a lot of lawyers don't have, to see how things are done on the inside. Because when you're negotiating with the studios, you know, you kind of run up against studio policies that are not necessarily logical. So when you sort of understand the studio accounting and the net profit definitions and the way they negotiate, it certainly gives you a leg up that you don't have to listen to that, and you don't have to follow what they say, because a lot of it is bull.
Oh, so you know what you can pay attention to and zero in on for your clients, it sounds like.
Yeah, it also lets you know, yeah, the limits of what you can and cannot get from the studios, right?
Oh, that's really interesting. Have you seen it shift a lot over the course of your career?
Well, yeah, the business has changed the last 5 years from streaming, which has dominated the industry. So there's been so many changes, I wouldn't know where to start in terms of talking about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in the past couple of years since the pandemic, it's been really volatile. It seemed like we were in peak TV through the pandemic, and then the shift as Netflix sort of transitioned, well, Wall Street made them transition, right, from just growth to now having to show profitability, which seems to have really changed the landscape. How has that affected the types of deals you've seen for your clients?
The amount of product that was being generated was unsustainable, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And it turns out to be right that now we're in the, you know, post-peak, you know, television. Yeah, they were putting out 600 shows or movies a year, and there was no way that the market you know, that everyone was just trying to expand and get market share. And there was no other way that that was going to continue forever. So now we've seen it level off and start to drop. A lot of people have been laid off, but there still is a lot more product being produced than I can ever remember. So there's still great opportunities for filmmakers, and it's still a great time to be involved in film and television, I think.
It's really great to hear that. And do you mean on the studio side or the indie side or both?
Well, both. You know, we're seeing a lot of action on the indie side as well as the studio side.
Oh, I love hearing that. And it's really refreshing for all of us. So in this time, I get asked a lot, especially by creatives, writers, directors, how do I protect myself coming into the industry with my projects, my ideas, and my opportunities? What advice do you have?
Well, I may have a different opinion than others, other lawyers might give. I wouldn't worry about protecting myself. I'd worry about getting out there. Contrary to what you might think, there's not that much theft of ideas and screenplays going on. There is some, and I've seen it for sure. But I think it's more important that I've seen writers be precious about their screenplays. Oh, should I have them sign an NDA when I said, no one's going to sign an NDA. And if you're so precious about your project because you're afraid of getting stolen, it'll never be seen. It'll never have a chance of getting produced. So I would say, yes, there is some risk, but don't worry about it. Don't think about it. Worry about getting stuff sold. In terms of protecting yourself, of course, you register with the Writers Guild. If you want a higher level of protection, you can register with the Copyright Office. It's only a few bucks, each of those. It's not a big expense. You know, you can certainly do that to protect yourself. But otherwise, don't worry about it. Don't ask anybody to sign an NDA. Just get your stuff out there and take the risk.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
What kind of mistakes do you see writers, creatives make that you think might be avoidable?
I think, again, I have to repeat myself, being precious about your project. I think if you're a writer, you keep writing. You send your script out there. If it doesn't get any action, you get, you know, you have your next one out there and you don't get discouraged by it. But I've seen some writers that they have their one screenplay. They're determined. They work on it for years. They try to get it sold. And in the end, they're frustrated. So I say, just keep churning out material and get it out there. Right. I always say that all you need is, you know, if you're doing a 1 hour show, you know, 60 diamonds. If you're doing a half hour show, you know, used to be 22 diamonds. Now the times are more flexible. A diamond meaning each page. So if you can churn out a perfect page and you can do that 22 times, you're off and running.
Yeah, I love that. It seems like great talent always really breaks through, can break through a brick wall in this industry. It really stands out and then everybody talks.
Another piece of advice I'd give is, you know, don't write something good, because good is not good enough to rise above the noise of the millions of scripts out there. It, you know, put out something excellent, something undeniable, that if you can get it to the assistant of an agent, if you're trying to break in, right, that it's so good that they fall off their chair.
Oh, I love that. Well, you said assistant of an agent. Do you think that that's approachable for new writers, or should they stick to looking for and querying managers?
Okay, yeah, well, I didn't mean that in terms of a way to get in. I was just using that as an example to illustrate the quality of the script you're trying yes. to come out with. But in terms of trying to get out there, yeah, the agents won't represent new writers, no matter how good. Mm-hmm. Certainly not an agent worth having, in my experience, that they'd rather steal a client than than develop one. So, you know, in terms of who's accessible, as you said, managers are a little more accessible because managers also want to be producers, right?
Yes.
So they're looking for material. Certainly producers are easier to get to than agents as well. So I would say, you know, a low level exec, you know, a development executive at a production company or at a management company is kind of a, you know, their doors are a little more open than other people and also, you know, can be a way in.
With creatives who are looking for an attorney, let's say they have a deal that's ready to go and they're like, gosh, okay, I think I need an attorney. They might not have an agent, so they're looking for an attorney to represent them in the deal. How do they find an attorney, vet an attorney, determine if that person is a good fit for them in their project?
Yeah, that's a good question. Most of the entertainment attorneys are certainly qualified and capable. I think you probably want to avoid someone who calls himself an entertainment attorney but doesn't have entertainment clients, because a lot of attorneys want to be entertainment lawyers, and it really requires some experience to be able to know the ins and outs of deals and know what you're doing. So I would say, you know, it's easy to check out, you know, an attorney. If you look at my IMDb page, you'll see literally several hundred projects that I've worked on. So I'm not saying it shows that I'm good or bad. It definitely shows that I have experience. And if you find someone with experience, most of them are capable.
Yes. And in terms of like fees, some of them want a retainer. Some of them are willing to work hourly. And then there's that 5% back end. Can you give an overview of that for someone who might be unfamiliar with how attorneys charge or what they should expect to pay?
Yeah. You know, attorneys, who represent talent often represent them on a 5% basis. That's why it's hard to get an attorney, because, you know, most writers don't succeed or most directors don't succeed. So the attorney would be spinning their wheels before they really had an expectation of making any money. So alternatively, you can pay an attorney to do an option contract or whatever it is that you need done. If you can't find someone to represent you on a 5% basis. And, you know, a contract will cost usually a couple grand to negotiate a simple contract. So, you know, some attorneys work hourly basis. Most of the entertainment attorneys work on a 5% basis, which means you have to attain a certain level of accomplishment before they'll represent you.
Yes. So if a writer is working with a producer and the producer says, I want to option your screenplay, at that point, is that the moment when a writer should find an attorney, or should they do some negotiating on their own with that producer?
Do not do that. We have seen so many. You don't have enough knowledge to negotiate the deals, no matter how sophisticated you think you may be, or actually may be. It's an art form. It requires experience and knowledge. If you have a producer who is a real producer, not just someone who calls himself a producer, who wants to option your material, you can get an attorney, because that shows, you know, you got something going on. You can get one. If the producer is not paying an option fee to option the material, then you don't want to give them an option. You want to give them what they call a shopping agreement. There are two ways that a producer can control material that they want to shop around and try to get produced. One is an option purchase agreement, and one is a shopping agreement. And I'll tell you the difference between that. Both of them have pluses and minuses. A shopping agreement is a very simple, like a two, three page agreement, that, and it's the only agreement that our firm allows the clients to do on their own, because it is so straightforward and simple. It just says to the producer, hey, you have a certain period of time, could be 3 months, 6 months, even 9 months, to shop it. See if you can get some action out there. You don't get anything for it. You don't get an option fee. If you get it sold, set up, then you negotiate your deal as a producer. I'll negotiate my deal as a writer. An option purchase agreement is something that requires an attorney, takes several months to negotiate, And it specifies everything that happens. So it'll say, here's an option fee. I would be wary of the $1 option. Again, if a producer says, I want to option this, but I don't want to pay you any money, say, well, we'll give you a shopping agreement. Because that keeps the writer in control of the material until it's sold to a buyer, right? So an option material would specify the option fee. It could be $1,000, it could be $5,000, it could be $50,000, it could be $100,000. And that would be applied against a purchase price. So the option is a smaller amount, which is paid to the writer. And then the producer tries to get all the elements together. And when they're about to make a movie, then they buy the rights. So it could be a $5,000 would be a typical option fee against $100,000 or $150,000 purchase price. Often it's a percentage of the budget, 2.5% of the budget. And it also specifies sequels, remakes, profits, credits, everything. It's a detailed agreement. That's why it takes several months to negotiate. And also, you'd have to hire an attorney to do that for you for a couple grand. So that's why if a producer doesn't want to pay you for an option agreement, you want to give them a shopping agreement.
Does that then become the step deal of how often the writer's going to get paid as it goes into production, et cetera? Is that the same contract or is that then a new contract once the property sells?
If you have a shopping agreement, then once the producer finds a buyer, then you'll negotiate an option purchase agreement. If you do an option purchase agreement right off the bat, that's the only agreement you'll have.
Right. So then you'll get the option and then you'll get paid when it sells.
When under an option purchase agreement?
Yes, you get the option.
Oh, you don't get paid when it sells. You get paid when they're, you get paid up front, an option fee.
Right.
And you get the purchase price once they know they're going to make the movie or
like television. When it actually is greenlit or goes into production. What's that moment?
Well, whenever they want to. Typically it's when they're about to greenlight, typically. But let's say a studio is, options the material. And let's say the option is running out. They just might buy it because, hey, we know we're going to make it at some point. Just buy it.
Huh.
But typically, yes, it'll be about when they know they're going to produce it.
How long does that negotiation take, like a spread?
To negotiate an option purchase agreement?
Yeah.
It takes a few weeks to a few months.
And what drives the complexity?
Well, there's a lot of different moving parts to it. Option fee, purchase price. We always try to get an executive producing component whenever we're selling a script, for a movie or TV. Profits, credit, sequels and remakes, covered by insurance, a boilerplate, representations, warranties, indemnity. It's usually a long back and forth.
So...
Faster. I mean, you can do it in a week, but I'm just saying typically it takes a long time.
And that sounds like an active negotiation because you're going back and forth in order to reach a deal, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Interesting. How much back and forth have you seen? Like, once or twice, or can it be like 10 times? What's typical? What's customary?
Both.
Oh, so it just really depends.
You can go a couple times or you can go 10 times or more.
Just really depends on the deal. And I know the studio's business affairs departments can be really slow to turn things around. So is that often why it can really stretch out?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So for writers who are on the call, who are in the audience, who might not necessarily know the differences between, we've been talking through on the film side, what about the television side as writers are getting staffed for the first time and they might not have representation, but they're like, when someone found them on Twitter and goes, oh my gosh, I want you in my writer's room, I'm going to staff you. And then they're like, oh my God, this is, my dream come true. At that point, would they be talking to an attorney before going into that room? When's the time that they would need to hire one?
If you have a writing job, no matter how lowly it might be on a show, you can get an attorney.
That's a good place to start.
I should have one. Yeah, you should have an attorney to negotiate that deal.
Yeah, because ideally, you know, that's your beginning point. You're going to move up.
Right. Right.
Is there a lot of difference? I mean, I know we've got the minimum basic agreement with the Writers Guild and what like a staff writer will get paid. But do you see variance in fees of what the writers are paid, like the first time they get staff, for instance?
No, I think that's typically scale.
It's typically scale. So when, at what point for them does it start to shift where they really need to negotiate? Like, is that the executive story editor? Is that co-producer? At what point are they starting to say, hey, you know,
It really is when you sell a pilot, right? When you sell a new project, that's your project. That's when you really negotiate from scratch and all bets are off.
As a creator.
Yeah.
With the created by.
The created by credit, which is the ultimate credit in television, the executive producer who gets the created by credit, that's the best credit. And there's a lot of really good things that come with getting that credit, pursuant to the Writers Guild and pursuant to contract as well. The created by credit is awarded to the person who writes the story of the pilot.
Not the script and the script?
Well, typically, it is the person who wrote the script as well, right?
Both, right?
Yeah. But whoever wrote the story of the pilot gets the created by credit.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that distinction.
So that's what you really want.
Have you ever seen, from your experience, any writers for whom they don't have a lot of television experience, but then manage to sell their own show and get that created by a credit? Because typically, it used to be you had to climb the ladder.
It's challenging because in order to get a show sold, you need a showrunner. How do you, you know, it'd be very hard to attract a good showrunner, and you need a good showrunner because it's got to be recognized by the network, right? As someone they trust to deliver scripts and shows. They want that, all the good stuff that comes from the created by credit too. So they'll be reluctant to sign on to your project if, you know, it's fully developed. They may co-create with you, you know, that's a possibility, right? But it's very hard to, if you're the breaking in, to get a showrunner, to get a series on the air with you being the creator, that's tough. It does happen. It can happen if the show is so compelling that it's undeniable.
Well, what if a writer did end up selling their show? They had less experience. They have to bring on a showrunner. Is it customary that they would just share the created by credit, or would they actually give up their created by credit and get perhaps like an executive producer credit, et cetera?
In most instances, I think that there would be rewrites required to suit the showrunner and the network.
Yes.
So depending on how much, the showrunner could get the sole created by credit or shared created by credit, depending on how much they change. So they would certainly be looking to get that at least shared, if not sole created by credit.
Right. So that's what they want. But what about this writer who, like, let's say that's your client and you're negotiating for them. What's your tack on that negotiation to try to help them retain as much control as they can possibly get?
I would say, again, don't be precious about it. If you're trying to break in, if the price of breaking in is sharing your created by credit with a showrunner, I wouldn't hesitate myself.
Right. So it really depends on how much experience the client has in terms of what they need to get out of that deal.
Absolutely. You know, it's a completely different situation if you have experience, even a new showrunner. But if you're a very experienced writer and you show you can handle what you're doing, you could become a showrunner even if you haven't done it before.
Well, let's change gears a little bit here because of it's coming out of my own viewing habits and reading a lot of the trades and seeing the kinds of deals that are happening. Let's talk about the shows that are getting on the air, the types of budgets and the buyers. I'm watching a lot of Apple right now. I'm really enjoying Masters of the Air and these incredible shows that are absolutely prestige TV. And you're going, okay, this has got to be, you know, a $10 million plus budget per episode. This is probably $100 to $200 million show. They seem to invest big like that. So does Amazon, Lord of the Rings. I mean, they spent how much, like $500 million between acquiring those rights and getting it on the air. And on the other side, we hear a lot of crying poor from some of the other streamers or studios who are like, oh no, we're not doing any period now. No, don't go selling any of your big budget period stuff right now in the industry. What's your take and perspective on the rumor mill of all that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I can't tell you how many times I've heard projects not selling. It's a period piece. It's a period. And then all you see on television is period pieces.
Yellowstone, all the rest.
You know, so it's like, this great project that my clients are working on, fantastic pitch, great material. It's period from the 40s. And that's what they got back from all the buyers. We're not doing period. We don't want to do period. And then all you see is period. It's like, what is going on? I don't know what that's about really.
I remember when I was at Inferno with your neighbor, Billy, back in the day, and it was just all over town, like no Westerns. Westerns are out. Nobody wants Westerns. And I think that that trend had kind of continued up until we got Jordan Peele and then Yellowstone happening. And it was like, Westerns are so hot and everybody wants to be Taylor Sheridan.
Really silly. I remember when there was a movie called Cutthroat Island. It was a pirate movie with Gina Davis, huge budget, Rennie Harlan directing, huge, like top budget at the time, over 100 million. And it bombed. And then for decades, literally, no one could make a pirate movie. It's like, it's not the genre. Cutthroat Island was a piece of shit, if I may, sorry. It has nothing to do with pirate movies. You make a good pirate movie, and of course, Pirates of the Caribbean.
Right.
Humongous success and sequels, et cetera. So, it's this groupthink that goes on, right? It's like a Western bombs, as you said, and then all of a sudden, nobody's making Westerns for years. It's like, no, it's not the Western. It's just a crummy show or movie.
Right. Maybe bad story or script that wasn't up to par. I mean, I feel like on the other side of the spectrum, I'm not even sure that we're getting the right takeaways from the massive success of Barbie, because now we're hearing like, oh, well, it's all about, now we need more Mattel movies. But I felt like Greta Gerwig's script and that incredibly feminist take on that's with this very original story was just so wonderful and refreshing and really designed for women, for a female audience. And I'm not sure that anyone I've spoken to has taken away that lesson from that movie, which, you know, once again, is where we are. It seems like we get there every year with, oh, it was the one female success story. It was Thelma and Louise. It was that one time women wanted to go to the theaters.
I'm with you on that. 100% agree.
Yeah.
You always get the wrong message, right? Like toy movies, which can be, if it's good, it's going to be successful. Just like, genre. It's like, do a good movie and people will come. Doesn't matter if it's period or genre.
Well, let's talk a little bit about representation, because I know you represent a lot of clients in the course of a year in your career, hundreds of deals from your company. How much have you seen representation shift since Me Too, since Black Lives Matter? Is it getting better or are we getting worse? What do you think?
In terms of diversity and inclusion?
Correct.
It seems to be getting better to me in both those, in terms of representation, in terms of awards, directing, acting. I'm not an expert in this. So, just as a casual person in the industry, it just seems to be much improved. I'm sure there's a lot more room to go.
Yeah, I love hearing that. Well, Philip, thank you so much for coming back on the show. It's always really wonderful to talk with you, to get your perspective.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Hollywood Wolfpack. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Please help our pack grow by sharing Hollywood Wolfpack with your friends and colleagues. Give us a rating and write us a review. Kaya loves hearing from you and reads them all. For more on Kaya and the Entertainment Business School, visit entertainmentbusinessleague.com. Until next week, remember, the strength of the pack is the wolf, and the strength of the wolf is the pack.